Hey, everybody, this is Chris Jones. How are you doing? I'm here with Mark Caro. It is After Hours with Rick Cogan. Rick is not here, but Mark Caro and I are here. We're going to keep Rick's seat warm for the next 2 hours here on WGN Radio.
Really warm. Keeping it so warm.
It's warm here in the Showcase studio. We got it all going on. So the Super Bowl, not yet over, but, I think
it kind of is, though. I think it's pretty close.
We're watching it so you don't have to. We're going to talk about the halftime show with Justin Timberlake. We've been watching the ads, so we're going to talk about the ads. We're going to talk about Pink. We are going to talk about the game, and then we're going to move on to other cultural topics here in Chicago.
Like the Puppy Bowl.
The Puppy Bowl, and all of those good stuff. All of that good stuff, all coming your way. So we hope you'll join us here for the next 2 hours as Mark and I talk about everything. So that's what we've got going on. So we're going to start out. Let's start out, Mark, with the – okay, this is the first review. You've heard. No one else has reviewed this yet. The first review, Mark, of the Justin Timberlake halftime show.
So I read Greg Kot's review already.
Just go for it.
Yeah, no, Justin Timberlake, you know, we'd love to hear from what you think, of course. It's 312-981-7200. You can text or call us and tell us what you thought. I thought that Justin Timberlake, I like Justin Timberlake. I wish he would act more. You know, he was really good
in
the Social
Network. Act more?
Act. He should act in movies. He was really good in the Social Network.
Oh, I see. Oh, the halftime show.
No, he's really good on hosting Saturday Night Live. I don't think he's really good performing at halftime of the Super Bowl. I don't know. You know what it is? It just reminded me of like one of those old Up With People things or like, frankly, or even like, you know, shouldn't say her name, but Janet Jackson, but that hyper choreographed product where all that Pepsi stuff at the beginning. And I felt like it all looked kind of like a Pepsi ad. And, you know, they had some of that, you know, innovative camera work because the camera's right on him and it's following him all around. But he was trying so hard just to sort of be a showman, but it was really hard to kind of get your hooks into any of those songs. And it just wasn't, I don't know. It just wasn't happening. It just seemed, you know, the thing that he did that killed it was he's in Minneapolis and does a tribute to Prince. So instead of a hologram, which I guess got nixed by Sheila E., they project Prince onto this big sheet. And they duet on I Will Die For You, which when you think about it is a really odd song for them to duet on. And then you're like, oh, yeah, Prince did a great halftime show. Oh, my God, that was like the best. Don't you wish you were watching the Prince halftime show right now? So I don't think he did himself any favors.
Can I bust in on this?
Oh, yes, you can.
Hi, my name is Lise. I'm producing you guys.
Hey, Lise.
We already met, but just want to make sure that
I didn't say nice to meet you. I just said, hey, Lise, welcome to the conversation on the air.
I'm just defending my boy, JT.
I like
huge
JT.
Fan. Yeah, okay, but okay, no. I mean, I'm with you. Well, no, I didn't watch the whole show. I just watched a little bit of it. But his new album came out on Friday. Have you had a chance to listen to it?
I've seen some of the YouTube clips. I've heard some of them. I've read the reviews, which are not that good.
Yeah, it's really heartbreaking for me because, like, I want to love it so badly.
Yeah,
like,
no, it's not happening.
And, like, 2020 Experience is, like, probably my top five favorite albums of ever. And, like, that says something, like, you know.
I put Sexy back on people's mixes.
Oh.
I have done that.
Obviously,
so I'm not way too old. Yeah,
every first track on any mixtape should be Sexy.
Okay, so let me. But, okay, go ahead. No, go ahead.
Well, okay, just my little tidbit on the album is just and you'll notice the first song is Filthy and that's great and that's what everybody's been hearing. That was the single. The second song is called Midnight I don't know, Midnight something, and it's like it really rips off. I think it sounds a lot like Chance the Rapper. And I can play a little bit of it for you later on the show, but it's just kind of weird because it's like just very clearly that style. And so I'm having like and I know you guys would be able to.
But this is all like throwback stuff for his halftime show, though.
He didn't do any of the new stuff?
I think he did some of it, but the style of it was very much like kind of throwback, the Michael Jackson dance moves and that sort of thing.
And everything
yeah.
Really early. Okay.
Yeah, and he did Sexy back. So I don't know.
How many songs did he do?
They just cram them all together. It becomes it's like a trailer of an actual concert. It's not really a show. It's just this medley.
So if you have an if you have an opinion on this show, just give us a call. 312-981-7200. You can also text us. Tell us what you thought. If you were watching the Justin Timberlake halftime show, tell us what you thought. I think, Mark, for a second, bear with me. I think you should just tell people what he did, just in case you didn't see it. What did he do? So if you missed it, what did you know, give us the just take us the play-by-play through
it. They start in the bowels of the stadium, and you see all these people taking pictures of him with their cell phones, which is sort of an obnoxious way to start, because you're like trying to see him past all these people taking pictures of him and these cell phones. And then you know, he comes in and he just did it, this medley, and it's just, you know, they had this huge brass band and they had his band, and I think there were people saying, you know, they thought he was kind of under-miked, you know, his voice sounded okay, but
was he live?
Great.
Did he feel live to you?
Well, there were enough people complaining about his pitchiness that it would appear that he was live. There were some people in our who were watching with us, because Chris and I were watching together with our families, who thought he was maybe lip syncing. I didn't necessarily think he was lip syncing.
I don't think he was.
I didn't think he was lip syncing, because I thought it was too kind of wobbly.
He was lip syncing. He wasn't even lip syncing. He wasn't pretending. It was a lot of it was backtracked. Like
he wasn't entirely. He had a live mic at various points.
Yeah, he definitely had a live mic.
Anyway, it's just this big, very choreographed thing where you had like all these people are dancing in front of him and jumping up and down like it's the most exciting. And you know that they've all been told to do that. And it's kind of like, and I think that when we talk about the ads, it's a similar theme. I think everything is so meta. It's like, it's an advertisement for itself. It's like, this is the advertisement for Justin Timberlake's halftime show, which is Justin Timberlake's halftime show. There's like nothing to really connect on. The camera work is so hyperactive and just zipping around all the place. Everyone there is jumping up and down way more than any normal person would.
Well, it's also, when you're speaking of meta, it's like you're watching people watching all the time. I mean, it's a fascinating kind of thing. You're actually watching, you know, the show ended with a selfie, and you would never have ended a Super Bowl show with a selfie, say 5 years ago. You would never have ended it in the stands with like a random kid who was having his 5 minutes of
fun. I don't know how random he was. Someone tweeted, they said he's going to turn out to be a racist or something.
He looked pretty right. He looked like he knew what he was doing particularly, but it was,
he had a little badge on though.
But well, he was in a rich kid's part of the stand, what can we say? But it's all social. I mean, it was essentially an attempt. It's this tension now that exists between spectacle, as it was, you know, this is the ultimate spectacle, but what they're trying to do is relate it to social media all the time. So you've got this, I think we're in this fascinating, this is my deep thought for the moment, we're in this fascinating transitional moment between performance and everything is a social occasion. And that show was half of one and half of the other.
I mean, the Ellen DeGeneres selfie at the Oscars was that 2 years ago or 3 years ago?
But it was Kevin Spacey in the back.
Kevin Spacey, your friend. This is trying to downplay his personal relationship with Kevin Spacey. But that moment has kind of come and gone too. So like Justin Timberlake at the Oscars, at the Super Bowl, taking selfies is like, okay, whatever. I like Justin Timberlake. I really do. I think that he's got a certain presence that, you know, I think Bruno Mars is a really great showman and I enjoy watching him do his stuff. I don't have any of his albums, but he's, you know, he's a showy guy and it's fine. But Justin Timberlake, partly because he's done all this SNL stuff, it seems like he's just a funny guy. If you could hang around with him, it would be fun. But it just sort of seemed like he was like a puppet on some strings of this thing. And I don't know. It's interesting. I mean, just his career in general. I mean, he's 37 now, I think. And, you know, he's doing this, you know, trying to do a sort of mature album, but it's kind of betwixt and between from what people are saying. And I don't know. I think his film career is, I think he should, I'm telling you, he should be acting in movies. I saw him in a movie called Alpha Dog years earlier, and he was so good in it.
I just feel that there's, people are frightened just to do a show anymore. Because they're like, oh, we have to relate to people in their cell phones. We have to be in the people. We have to be constantly relating to how people are watching and consuming the show. If we just do a spectacle, which is what Prince did at the end of that era of the great spectacle, this is a sort of it was trying to be populist, you know, out in the audience, and you've got this combination of real dancers and what looked like sort of real people, sort of. You couldn't really tell.
No, they're like up with people.
Public people. They were like, you know, professionally moving their hand people. But it's difficult. It was a weird hybrid of a show, I say. I didn't like it very much, I gotta say.
Nah. It would, you know, and they should have brought out Janet Jackson, because
why not?
Janet
why
Jackson, she
why
took the brunt
that?
Of that when they were on, what was that, 2004,
the
I think
the wardrobe
it was.
Malfunction.
The wardrobe malfunction, and his career was fine, and her career really suffered. And it's like, come on, you know, and maybe there were overtures made. I don't know what I know she had a statement at least today or yesterday saying I'm not on it, just in case anyone was wondering. But it would have been a classy thing for her to come out and for that to be sort of a, you know, it's like you're giving the World Series ring to Steve Bartman moment, because Janet Jackson suffered for that and Justin Timberlake did not, and it wasn't really fair.
So it would have been like a wardrobe function. It would have been somehow the reverse of the wardrobe malfunction.
Yes, she could have put a fake, you know, chest onto Justin Timberlake. I don't know. That's a terrible idea.
I thought the coolest thing, though, was, did you not like the bit where they went outside the stadium and you had that kind of had Prince all over Minneapolis? That was cool.
That was cool. But again, all it did was remind you that you wished you were watching Prince. I mean, they should have had a Husker Du, you know, Grant Hart thing while they were at it, too. I mean, he died more recently than Prince did, but that's, you know.
Well, they're in Minneapolis. They're in
Well, that's where Husker Du is from. Well,
Prince is bigger than, you know, Prince is Prince.
Prince is bigger than Husker Du? Is that what you're saying? He is bigger. But, you know, Husker Du is pretty great group, though. They could have gotten Bob Mould out there to join Justin Timberlake, and they could have done a little Minneapolis thing, get Paul Westerberg out there, get the Jayhawks.
Okay, so Mark and I are not very impressed with the Justin Timberlake halftime show. If you have an opinion, 312-981-7200, or send us a text, and we will be right back. All right, here's Justin Timberlake bringing us back to After Hours. I'm Chris Jones. I'm here with my co-host, Mr. Mark Caro.
Hello.
We're sitting in for the great Rick Kogan on this post-Super Bowl, post-Philadelphia Eagles victory evening. Talking halftime show. We're about to talk about our favorite and least favorite Super Bowl ads.
We're bringing sexy back to WGN.
We got it going on. We hope you'll join us and you hope you hang out and listen for a while. If you want to tell us what you thought of Justin Timberlake, might upset our producer if you don't like her, though. But if you don't like him, so just be nice.
She doesn't like that new album, though.
312-981-7200. Or you can text us at the same number, 312-981-7200. And the game is over.
Yeah, Chris, the Eagles won.
What do you think of that? Was you happy?
Oh, that was the music cue. We're going to come in with Fly Like... Well, next time, we'll just... Don't tell anyone. Steve
but
Miller
you just
Band.
Did tell everybody.
No. They weren't really paying attention. They didn't get the whole thing. They named that tune. It was not enough. But hey, the Eagles won.
Is that good?
The Eagles have landed. Yeah, it's good. Yeah, of course it's good. You know why it's good? Because we're in Chicago, and Michael Jordan got 6 rings, and Tom Brady has 5. So cut out the stupid comparisons between NFL quarterback Tom Brady and greatest pro athlete who ever lived, Michael Jordan. Thank you very much.
So there was a piece in, I think it was in the LA Times this morning that I was reading, and it was sort of saying that these two teams are sort of, you know, sort of emblematic of the splits in America. You've got the sort of the Patriots, which is kind of a friendship with Donald Trump, a kind of a, you know, this kind of very, very, very establishment, very, very together team versus the Eagles. The AKA the most woke team in the NFL, who do all this, you know, good stuff and woke ideas and sort of progressive notions.
What kind of woke ideas?
Well, they do stuff like, you know, charity events, and they're better at sort of giving their money away and all of that. Sort of seeing the game as emblematic of these two, you know, of this. What do you do? Any credence to that?
Well, and you could say that the Patriots, everyone's sick of them. Everyone's sick of using patriotism as a weapon. Brady did have his friendship with Trump, although I don't know how deep that goes. Everyone's kind of tired of the Patriots.
Friendship?
But you know what, though? I will say this. Having lived in Boston, not a red state or city. Massachusetts, not a red state. Boston, not a red city. So, you know, sometimes people get a little bit overboard with the symbolism. I'm happy Philadelphia won. Some of their fans are kind of pills, but, you know, I went to school in Philadelphia. I like Philadelphia. I think Boston has won enough. New England's won enough. I think that I understand the symbolism there, Chris Jones, but I wouldn't necessarily. If you polled everyone on the team and each team, I'm not sure you would really find that Trump woke split. But I don't know. I haven't done the research. I didn't write the piece.
Well, let's take a look at some of these ads, okay? So one of the great fun things about Super Bowls is, of course, Super Bowl ads. You can watch
them. You can never go to the bathroom because you can't go during the ads because you're supposed to be paying to the ads. And then during the game, something unscripted might actually happen. There might actually be some excitement, so you just can't go to the bathroom.
All right, so I'm going to lay out what I think was the meta. This is an interesting question. What was the sort of meta theme of the ads? If you accept the notion that the ads sort of represent the zeitgeist of the country, these are, after
do you,
all.
Do you accept that? Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
For the second, you know,
yes,
going with the idea.
Sorry.
Going
I'm
with
sorry.
The idea.
I'm going with your idea.
They represent
Chris.
The zeitgeist of this is the trials that I have to suffer. Going with the zeitgeist of the country. Now you see, I'm all. If you don't accept the idea, then I get all.
I
the,
accept the
I get
idea.
All the
I do.
Flung, now I have to like, recover.
Listeners,
from
did
it.
I not accept the idea? I accepted the idea.
All right. So if they're the zeitgeist of the country, like you know, what are they saying about America at this moment? Well, this is my thesis. It's three words, and it came from a car ad tonight. and the thesis was. Hope comes standard.
Right.
So I would say that these ads generally, compared to previous years, were less political, less divisive, and were notable for their message of sort of hope and unity. Now, that's not wildly unusual. I grant you that, you know, this idea that we're all one, but it was especially striking tonight. And the other thing that I would say is that there truly is now no conscience in selling a car, say, on the back of any human misfortune,
right,
or human challenge,
like
not
the
just
Hyundai.
Misfortune.
The Hyundai ads were: if you buy a Hyundai, we're helping.
And you're therefore, if you the implied thing being, if you're not buying a Hyundai, then you're not helping people with cancer,
right? Unless you're buying a Toyota, and then you're helping athletes who were born without legs.
Yes, right. So, but there's this idea, and then of course Dodge. You know, then the ultimate was being sold with the words of Martin Luther King.
I booed. I booed the screen. I booed your personal screen at that point. When they had like 50 years ago today, Martin Luther King said this, and they used that to sell a truck. That was over the line. That was just like, how much appropriation of anything meaningful do we have? Does every single thing in our culture have to be monetized? That was depressing to me. Leave Martin Luther King out of your ads. If he were alive, he would not be endorsing a truck. End of story.
And if you look at the history of Dodge Ram ads, that it is a departure, right? It's not like this brand.
Well, didn't they also? I think they had one where the "We Will Rock You" also. That was right. Earlier in the project. So it was like, well, yeah, we'll run the Queen one, and then we'll run the Martin Luther King Jr. one. That's a coherent 1-2 punch.
But what about? Let me just drill in on this question, though. Are you offended by selling cars based on? If we accept now that marketers are all, obviously everyone wants to sort of sell things based on personal stories. That's kind of where we're at in the narrative now.
Right.
It's all about personal story. Is it justified to say, to use that, these sort of stories of togetherness, and at the end of it, it's Toyota or it's Hyundai or it's any of these things?
I don't think there's anything wrong with promoting unity and togetherness and, you know, non-discrimination and inclusiveness, and using that and trying to attach your brand to that. You know, if Budweiser wants to attach itself to delivering water to people who've been ravaged by hurricanes, yeah, that is fine. So I don't have any problem with that. I do have a problem with sort of the attachment of, you know, like, here's Gandhi on his hunger strike. You should eat at McDonald's. I mean, that didn't happen, but
you mean
that's
if it's
sort of
a, you mean if it's a, if it's the
it's
opposite.
Just the appropriation of things that were meaningful in a deep way, like Martin Luther King is meaningful in a deep way, and to use him to sell a truck just seems like, no, you don't get him.
Yeah, but I'm bothered by the idea of, like, if you say, okay, they get, you know, we give a portion of our sales to cancer, which is a good thing for a car company to do, but you don't know what portion of the sale is going to that, right?
Right.
So you don't really have any, and you still
never
don't.
Do though. I mean, that's the nature of these promotions. But that ad was just so manipulative with like the testimonials of people and them walking out from behind the door to give hugs to people who bought Hyundais, like, you helped me with my cancer treatment. It just was over the top.
I mean,
top.
If someone did that to me, I would be like, I didn't do anything. I just bought a car.
Right.
You know.
I'm glad for you.
I mean,
but, you know, it's
you
like,
know.
It's one thing if you actually gave them a kidney, but if you just bought a Hyundai.
You don't deserve.
And also, frankly, from Hyundai's point of view, it's not like they're saying our cars are good.
Right.
They're saying, well, I don't know if you like the car, but you'll help some sick people.
I believe we got some text. You want to hit us with see what people are saying about. We're talking, if you're just joining us, we're talking about the Justin Timberlake halftime show at the Super Bowl, and we're talking about some of the ads you might have seen. So
yeah.
What are people saying?
So, sorry, that was like a very intense gasp. So from the 847, we have a very I think you guys will like this text. Chris Jones crystallized my thoughts exactly.
Oh, yes.
I agree that performers are compelled to be populist and tailor their performance because of their hyper-awareness of cell phones. I'm 47 years old. I didn't watch the game. I don't have a television. But if I could have my way, I would just want to see Tom Petty perform.
Oh, there you go.
Thank you, Mary. That was very well written.
Sure, exactly.
Please send more. I want more of this.
I know. I'd be happy to see Tom Petty. Is this a bizarre? It is like, what is this about wanting to put cell phones into performances?
I know. You know,
why are people doing that?
You know, it was a good ad. I'm just going to jump in real quick with it, since we're talking about this. The Modelo ad that was on sort of later on.
Yes.
Where it had that line. Doesn't matter where you're from. Doesn't matter where you've come from. It matters what you're made of. And I thought that was sort of, if you want to sort of get into a zeitgeist thing.
Yeah, that's good. That's
like,
good.
That was a Mexican beer, and that was sort of pointed, and so it was a little more political, but it also had that unity thing going on, but it all kind of worked in a way that most of these things felt tacked on. I have kind of just I don't know if we're going to have to run to a break because I could bring this up afterwards, but I have a larger forest than trees.
Okay, well, hold that thought for a second.
The ads on the Super Bowl. I have a thought about that.
So if you've got opinions on the ads on the Super Bowl, you can text us 312-981-7200, or you can call us at 312-981-7200. If you're wondering who is here, this is Chris Jones and Mark Caro, my friend over there at the other microphone. We are in for Rick Hogan, who's, you know, on the road today. We're keeping his seat warm. We're here for Rick Hogan's After Hours. We're excited to be here, and it's time for the news. Hey, everybody, this is Chris Jones here with Mark Caro.
Hey.
We're in for Rick Hogan. You're listening to WGN 720. We're keeping Rick's seat warm all the way through until 11 o'clock. If you're driving home from your Super Bowl party, drive safely out there because it's looking a little kind of murky here in the Toasty Showcase studio right here on the Boulevard de Mich. We're here for you, and we're talking about the Super Bowl ads. And before we went to the break, so Mark, you were about to say you have this, not the trees, but the forest, the deep Mark Caro.
the deep Mark Caro.
The deep Mark Caro thought. And what did all those ads together, before you give us that, if you would like to talk Super Bowl ads, 312-981-7200, or you can text us, or if you want to talk about Justin Timberlake, we are here for you. We're taking your opinions. We watched it. Okay.
And so, you know what else they can do? They can tweet us.
I think tweet us.
They could tweet us at Chris Jones is at Chris Jones
Trib.
T-R-I-B. And I'm at Mark Caro, M-A-R-K-C-A-R-O. And if you tweet us, then you'll become actual human Twitter followers of ours.
That's good.
And we're in favor
we'll
of that.
We'll talk about that
and
later.
I think we're going to talk about that
talk
later.
About that
so
later.
There's a little preview.
All right. So, right to it. What did the ads say about America? What did those ads, what was the big picture? What was the big picture?
Well, we talked about them. My point is that, okay, people out there, he is shaking his head like I'm not going along with his premise, but it was my premise in the first place, which is that I was going to make a point, but it's not about what it says about America. Is there a camera on in here? You should see his face
radio,
right now.
On radio.
Okay. No, we have a, there's a webcast of this stuff. Yeah, I think we can look. Yeah, live stream at WGNradio.com. You can watch this. It's horrible.
Can't help it.
I just wonder, the Super Bowl ad has become like this thing, Super Bowl ad, all caps, and it's been like this for years. And now there are all these stories that you read in the days leading up to it. Here are the sneak peeks of the Super Bowl ads you're going to see. And so you can watch like most of these ads online before you've even seen them in the Super Bowl. So they're not even, like, if you're actually paying attention and following the stuff online, you know, the Doritos ad with, you know, like Morgan Freeman and, God, I'm just blanking my name.
The guy from Game of Thrones.
Peter Dinklage. I know him. I go way back with that guy to Sundance. Anyway, you've seen that ad already.
You go way back to that guy to Sundance?
I remember seeing him in Sundance, yes.
Live or on a screen?
Both. But he's excellent. He's awesome. There's a station agent. I think the station agent was the movie that I saw him in originally. Oh. Anyway, the point is that it's like you've sort of seen these ads already because they're putting them online because they want you to share them online. Because as you, as to your point about the Justin Timberlake halftime thing, everything is about social media now. So the ads are less about selling the product than they are about getting in to the mainstream. Channels, and they know, that, and everyone knows that they're going to be reviewed because, I mean, you know, the Tribune, I mean, Steve Johnson, I mean, he was reviewing them, you know, as they came up online and does a nice job with it. But it, so, it, so you're not really like watching an ad if you've already seen it online. And it's again, it's like the Justin Timberlake thing was like a trailer for Justin Timberlake show, and the ads are like, I don't know, it's like they're just like, here's the stuff that you've already seen. Well, online.
It, a lot of it I think is because they just want to get the brand in, they want to get, it's about being talked about, right? It's about it's a little bit like, you know, it's a little bit like walking into the Bonobus store on Southport Avenue, which is near where I live, and I you know, you walk in there, you can't buy anything, you can just walk around and see the clothes and you order them later. I think that's to some degree what you're talking about, that these ads have become you know, they're just brand, they're all about starting conversation.
So the Tide ads were relatively funny. I mean, you got your guy from Stranger Things on and the whole thing was meta. It was about, look, it's a Tide ad. All these cliches from other Super Bowl ads are in this, but it's a Tide ad. So the ads are like about the ads because everyone is watching the ads to judge them as ads rather than experience them as ads to actually have them convince you to buy anything. And I didn't find that most of them, like the ones that I watched, like you sort of have your random weird celebrity stuff in there, but I didn't find it all seems kind of formulaic at this point. Like we've sort of done all this stuff, right?
All right, well, let's hear from some of the folks out there. We have George is here to talk about the de-evolution.
De-evolution? I just made that up.
That was you.
I thought he was like a Devo.
He sounds like a
I thought he was a Devo fan.
The de-evolution of the halftime show.
Let's get Devo to play that.
Devo should do the halftime show.
All right. Okay. George, you're on with Chris and Mark here on After Hours.
Hey, what's going on?
How are you doing? Thanks for calling. Did you watch the halftime show? What do you think?
You know, I did watch it. From what I could hear from it being the noisiest bar and stuff. You know, I'm really disappointed that the NFL over the past, you know, 10 years, they seem to adopt sort of this, like, throwback sort of theme, bringing back old artists and kind of reviving old teams. I'm really surprised that Justin Timberlake didn't invite the rest of the NSYNC members to do kind of a throwback NSYNC concert.
Right.
That would have been amazing.
At one point, my wife tonight, she goes, really funny that he didn't bring the Backstreet Boys with him.
Oh, that was mean of you to point that out.
Face palm.
Yeah, no, it's true. Yeah, he was on with NSYNC like years ago. I think the year that Aerosmith was on, I think he showed up with NSYNC. That was like, or before the whole Janet Jackson thing.
Are you being sarcastic there? Are you actually saying you should have brought NSYNC?
I'm being totally, totally genuine.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, like if you're doing a throwback, you may as well do it all the way.
Yeah. Well, I think this is them trying to be modern, even though his whole thing was kind of throwback because he was sort of doing his style from, you know, over 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But, have you guys ever seen Justin Timberlake live? Any of you? George,
like
have
to.
You?
I never have.
I've
no.
seen him, yeah. I absolutely have.
What did you
think? What was it like?
Lisa's like,
she's changing the conversation.
If you bring up Justin Timberlake.
His live shows are incredible.
Where did you see it? Where did you see him?
I saw him, that was in Miami.
Oh.
What about you, Lise?
Yeah. I saw him in Sheffield, actually.
Oh, Sheffield,
this
England.
Is weird. He played Sheffield, UK. It's like a tiny, you know. I mean, it's not that tiny.
It's a
student
nice
city,
town.
But I mean, you know, it's like this, what? It's not like, you wouldn't think J2 would
it's
go
It's not Miami.
There. Okay. So he played... George, it's kind of windy, so I'm going to let you go, man.
Okay.
All
right.
So
thanks,
much.
George.
Thanks for calling, George.
Thanks, George. He's walking back from that bar he was just telling
us. Okay. So
he's
Sheffield.
Like, he's cold right now.
I feel like I'm back
he's
in
cold
England.
Right now.
But no, okay, wait. It was a 2020 experience tour, and I just want to tell a story. That's why I asked the leading question.
Go ahead.
Anyway,
Lise, tell us your Justin Timberlake story.
Oh, I didn't know if you'd ask, but so I had just moved there to study abroad. I was like, I'd been there for 2 weeks. My best friend had just seen him here at the United Center. Mm. And she, like, we FaceTimed, you know, and she's like, oh my God, you've got to go. he's going to Sheffield. I was like, what? No, he's not. And then I looked, and sure enough, he was. It said it was sold out, but then I just tried to buy a ticket anyway. I don't know why, but it let me buy a ticket. So basically, they were still selling single tickets, but they said sold out because I figured no crazy person would, no Brit would go by themselves to a Justin Timberlake concert.
No self-respecting Brit.
Right. But I was neither self-respecting nor Brit. So I was there. I bought my ticket, and then I like showed up, and I was just like, it was like amazing. And I had actually just gotten in a kind of a fight with an English girl at a different concert that I had gone to in Manchester, of Montreal, over a set list. But then I another one at Justin Timberlake.
You got into a fight with someone?
Not a fight, but like an altercation, which I never would have.
Well, there you go. Well,
but it was awesome. And he, it was just like a beautiful beautiful show. So I think it would have been pretty magical to be there. And I don't think that they were faking it. You say like jumping up and down, they were like totally doing that for the screen.
On. Somebody had gone, you guys have got to do the hand thing. That was sure.
Oh, what was the hand thing?
Well, they all did like a sort of choreographed hand thing where they would all bring their hands with a cell phone in their hand.
All right. I have like an old man comment. What would Justin Timberlake have been like if he had been like 20 years earlier and everything was, and he would have just sort of been, it would have been all on his, his own charisma and everything else, and just wasn't so much pop machinery behind him. Because I just think he seems like such a talented guy. And when when you see him on Saturday Night Live and he does his song about the box, for instance, like he's just so funny.
Yeah.
And he just has so much charisma. And then when the thing has to be so big.
Yeah.
And it just has to be so corporate, you just lose the dude in there. And he's too careful.
We're talking, you got some text, right?
Yeah, 708. Okay. Hi, just my opinion. That's very nice. That's like a nice cordial.
That's all we got here. That's all we got is opinions.
They might be British, actually. Very like. But I thought the halftime show was not good. I turned on something else to check it out. Big mistake. Oh,
He turned a different channel off.
Whatever. Right. I have absolutely nothing against Justin Timberlake, but the show is in no way entertaining. And then 262 says JT isn't a throwback. He's doing country and pop and SNL very well liked.
Oh, so that person is it. So that's throwback.
We just meant that he was doing songs from like his first and second solo albums.
That's another
out in the early 2000s.
That's another Justin Timberlake fan who's being insulted by all this talk of
that's
JT.
That's actually me. I texted that.
Just JT is not really a throwback. Yeah.
I just didn't think the show was the unveiling of his new persona.
Well, no, but it's not supposed to be.
I'm not saying it was. I'm just saying in response to the texture.
Oh, okay. Well, who was the Super Bowl last year? Who was the halftime?
Lady Gaga.
It's the Coldplay thing, the weird Coldplay thing that was 2 years ago.
Where they needed Beyonce to prop them up.
Oh my God. I was like, what the heck? I watched that actually. I was in Dublin watching that at like 4 in the morning or whatever.
They were doubling down on Beyonce.
Yeah, man. Oh, good one. All right,
we really should go to a break. Hey, if you want to just send us a text, give us your views on Justin Timberlake and on that show, or you can call us if you just want to do that. 312-981-7200. This is Chris Jones, Mark Caro, Radio 720 WGN. We'll be right back.
Right behind my left pocket. That is.
Hey, everybody, this is Chris Jones. I'm here with Mark Caro.
Hello. Listening
to Radio 720 WGN. We're in for Rick Hogan. This is the great Rick Hogan Show After Hours with Rick Hogan. Rick is not here, but Mark and I are here keeping Rick's seat warm. You're listening to the dulcet tones of Justin Timberlake, I think.
Sounds nothing like what he just did.
If you're watching the halftime, it's completely different. But the halftime show at the Super Bowl is what we've been talking about. We've also been talking about all of the ads that you guys maybe would have been watching if you're right now in your car on the way back from a Super Bowl party. If you want to pull over and text us and tell us which your favorite ads were, we'd love to hear that. Mark, in the last segment sort of talked a lot about how these, what these ads were sort of saying. Here is my thesis for all of the ads. Ready? This is my thesis, my big thesis. This is the beginning of unity. So my thesis is that we're moving away from divisiveness. Let's begin it with the State of the Union address. This is going to be highly controversial. Ooh. But let me finish. That people are now paying a little more attention to sort of unified I think those ads were notably, were all one, really, as if corporate America is saying, look, it really, we really sell more cars if everybody's on the same page.
Right.
And we really want everybody to be unified. And so it was a very, very kumbaya. And the Justin Timberlake show sort of fit into that. You were just saying earlier, Mark, it's sort of up the people type of thing.
Sure.
The whole thing was very, of course, then you had all these guys bashing each other's heads in while you were watching that.
Yeah. I mean,
well, that's
no, it's oh, that's fine. Look, we're in a very divisive time in time in our culture right now. And so it makes sense that that you know, I mean, ads are meant to be, you know, aspirational, what we want to become. And they're meant to be positive. And the Super Bowl is meant to be positive. Nobody wants, you know, nobody's looking for a political Super Bowl the way they look for maybe a political Oscar show or political Grammys or something like that. So that makes perfect sense. And there's also the other thing is that there's kind of a walking on eggshells quality to what the corporations are doing, because they're really trying hard not to offend anyone because they're afraid they're going to get flamed on social media. So they're all kind of tame. I mean, look, the good thing is that you didn't have the really obnoxious sexist like GoDaddy ads this year, right? You would have these kind of weird sexual, I mean, you did have the one bleep don't stink one, which
that was
just,
I thought that was a Febreze air freshener, right?
Yeah, basically the one guy whose bleep doesn't stink, it doesn't need Febreze, but everyone else does.
And like, they actually,
okay,
and they went,
we're all sitting here eating our chili watching the Super Bowl, thanks for having us think about that.
But they went so far as to even say at your party there are people
exactly.
Stinking up your party right
with
now
your chili beans. They
with
didn't
your
say chili beans. They didn't say chili beans.
They said chili. That at the end of the ad, the little character came back and said, "Is that chili?" No, that was
See,
a different ad.
That was maybe probably that was just me. But yeah. So I mean, there was nothing in there that you would say was like pushing any envelopes tonight. It's all. Take a deep breath. Let's all, you know, pretend that everything's okay for a few hours while we have the Super Bowl going on, and try to associate us with the positive things, because we know that most people in the U.S. are really sick of all the divisive, horrible stuff. And now here's a Genie Ives ad. Oh, I didn't say that. But anyway, So there you go. It's the quest for unity makes sense right now.
Well, I think, you know, and also, of course, you've got the whole idea of personal aspiration. Like there was, I think it was a Jeep ad, or maybe, I think it was Jeep, where they said, the road is somebody else's idea and that your idea is to go off road, you know, right? So it's this idea of personal. And of course, you know, you've got NBC, you've got the Olympics coming up, you've got the FIFA, you've got the FIFA World Cup coming up. So there's, it's a time to tell, you know, they always worry with these, big sporting events like the Olympics. They always worry that people aren't going to watch. So they always try to involve people in different, in sort of different personal stories of the athletes. So you were beginning to see that in the ads for the Super Bowl. They were like priming you for all of these, you know, they've got the Winter Olympics starting Friday night is the opening ceremony. So we're being primed now for these personal stories of courage and all of that.
Where do you think someone would jump in though and be like, hey, it's the Super Bowl, Super Bowl ads, they're all, you know, the Super Bowl ads are all being looked at a lot. And so maybe we'll try to make some sort of statement about something. There just was like, this is the showcase where you could actually try to say something that would make a difference.
But look at the moment too, right? You've got in the sort of
everyone's scared.
And I think these were cautious ads because
the last thing
you want to do is offend anybody. We've got some more texts coming in about the
offensive text. 312. No, not at all. Hi, Phil from Chicago. He said he likes JT, but it was flat. Bad audio, drab outfits. It was kind of the weird clothes.
I thought it was drab. I see a lot of.
Drab's
I think
a really
drab
good
is,
word for it.
You know,
it like looks like fall, like Gap's fall collection that
well,
like
was,
went through like a mud bath or
it
something.
It was part camouflage. Did you notice that?
It was
part camouflage, but it wasn't a full on camo. It was like a mix of two. I was staring at that actually because I thought those were bizarre.
Yeah.
It was a bizarre mix.
But, and then he said Prince tribute was nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just reminded you'd rather be watching Prince.
Why didn't they just do Purple Rain, though? Why did they have to do... I mean, I love this. I would die for you
with the guy
just,
who died.
I know.
It made sense.
I don't know. Here's my other deep thought on the Super Bowl as we wrap up our discussion this afternoon.
We've got to talk some football still here.
Oh, yeah. We've got a few more minutes.
Go Eagles.
The So my kids watch FIFA. They play FIFA, the game FIFA. I'm also convinced, this is my other great pronouncement of the day, that we're beginning to see the melding of the human and the digital. I'm convinced that these broadcasts, and it's partly for me the filmic sort of quality they do, the way they film that halftime show, that sort of very, very textured-y thing. And if you look at the stills of the players, they look exactly like the digital image in FIFA now to me. And it's like I'm just sort of watching it and going, you know, and you think about all the, you know, the concussions and all the dangers that the players face. I actually think we're seeing, I kid you not, I'm really saying this seriously. I really am, that you're beginning to see, ultimately, this will be a digital experience. Everything about the game that you're beginning to see.
What, you mean that they're going to replace the players with digital?
I think the
ultimate, no one will get concussions because there won't be a virtual Tom Brady playing?
There'll be robots
down,
playing
down,
football?
Down.
I'm asking you.
I think that, no, I'm actually am saying that.
That's what I'm asking.
I actually am saying that. I actually think the ultimate manifestation of that. And I think, here's what I think. The smart viewer can see this already because of the way the digital and the human is melding in that entire spectacle.
Maybe it's already happening. Maybe it was all like a programmed. maybe.
Well, the Sprint ad was basically that. So you got to give that
it?
One.
What was it?
Where they had the guy making the robots and then the robots start selling him.
Yes, that's right.
They laugh at him for still having Verizon.
Which is really saying pay more attention to what robots think. If you look at the Uber text of that ad, it's saying don't upset your robots.
Right?
Like the robots can take offense.
Yeah, bringing this back to Justin Timberlake.
You got more text on him too.
I will. But the did you see the Filthy music video?
I did not see that. Did you see that, Mark?
What's the Filthy music video?
It sounds dirty when I say that's the
where's the Filthy music video?
Oh, most of them in top 40 music. But no, Justin Timberlake. It's a robot thing.
Yeah.
I'll show you guys.
Oh, I think I saw that.
No, it's robotics are, you know, are kind of in.
So Justin Timberlake has his own line of clothes, William Rast.
That's right.
He wore.
Yeah, that's right. That's a helpful addition to the discussion.
Designed by someone that also goes hunting, I guess. Like cat camouflage. Yeah.
Well, to your point, Chris,
yes,
about the digital stuff. I mean, we're watching the game and, you know, there's some very exciting plays in there. That fourth down, going for it, the Eagles at the end of the first half, where they tossed it to Nick Foles, the quarterback. That was some great razzle dazzle. And you're like, oh shoot, I actually like this game, because part of me is thinking, I want this game to be really terrible so I don't feel like I need to watch anymore. And not just because I found the Bears kind of, you know, not likable and stupid as an organization right now, but also just because it doesn't really feel that good watching football anymore. And, you know, Brandon Cooks, the wide receiver for the Patriots, I mean, he just gets this vicious helmet-to-helmet hit, and
really
he's out for
way.
The whole game. And, you know, I mean, on one hand, it was a legitimate hit. He was looking the wrong way. The guy blindsided him. That's what, you know, the defensive guys do. But on the other hand, those helmets did hit. He was knocked out. He had a head injury. They didn't call it a concussion, but they did call it a head injury. He was out for the rest of the game. And that, so much of football now is dictated by who's standing at the end of the game and at the end of the season.
I'm just saying, you look at the full digital picture of what you're watching, and I'm including the halftime show, I'm including the ads, and I'm including the game, and you sort of go, at some point, you imagine somebody at the NFL going, you know, do we really need real people in there who are going to get hurt? Can't we really pretty much replicate? And I'm
so would you go to like Soldier Field and you'd have like holograms on the field, or would
you
just
mock? But
I'm not mocking. I'm asking
saying,
you questions.
I'm just
a little defensive today, Chris Jones.
I just think that it's. I think that the fusion of it will eventually be that. Maybe you will actually do that at Soldier Field.
That's what I'm asking. I mean, there's a whole thing with holograms and hologram concerts. But, you know, people like seeing the actual amazing physical feats of athletes. And that's why football is so tricky, because a diving catch in the end zone is really thrilling, but some guy getting knocked out and lying on the field for 5 minutes is really horrifying. Or, you know, having Zach Miller's leg get bent in a way it should not get bent, and then you hear later that it was almost amputated. That just makes you feel bad about it. And all these guys walking around who are like not themselves afterwards because they have CTE. I mean, it's a serious, you know, football is at this really interesting crux right now where it could go either way. Everyone still watches the Super Bowl. I don't know what the ratings are going to be. It seemed like an especially good game this year. So I'll be curious whether this helps football come back, because it's not been back this year. It's been down.
So there's a text came in from somebody, 262 area code, best commercial, WeatherTech made in America as it should be. You know, it was interesting what you said to me when that WeatherTech, actually what several people said in that moment was, what does WeatherTech make? And I hear their radio commercials, and I knew they make all season mats for cars.
Right.
But that was fascinating. That was a WeatherTech commercial without any mention of their product. Sort of interesting. No.
And I was like, oh, they make weather stuff. Of course they're in the U.S.
They're centered out here.
They're right in the suburbs.
Yeah. It's made in USA sort of thing.
Yeah, so that was one of our listeners' picks for the best commercial. If you're wondering what you're listening to Chris Jones and Mark Caro. We're here. We're in for Rick Hogan and his after-hours show. You're listening to Radio 720, WGN Radio. We've got the news coming up. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, you can just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn.
Welcome back to WGN After Hours with Rick Hogan, except Rick Hogan is not here, so you have his two people trying to fill his seat. This is Mark Caro with my good friend Chris Jones.
Hey.
And we've been talking about the Super Bowl. We hear that the Eagles won. I, for one, am happy about that. And, you know, we are kind of flying like eagles through this show, don't you think, Chris Jones?
That's a great metaphor.
Time keeps on slipping into the future.
It
That's
does.
What I always say.
Yes, it does.
So we've been talking about the Super Bowl, and we've been talking about Justin Timberlake and ads and all these deep thoughts. And you're welcome to call or text. Join us, 312-981-7200. A little bit later, we're going to talk about our Twitter followers. I'll show you Chris mine if he'll show me his. But now we're going to switch gears and talk about movies, because I know that Chris has been seeing a lot of movies.
Yeah.
I've been seeing a lot of movies. I've seen all the Best Picture nominees
now.
Yeah,
me too.
And I've also, of course, because this is something I do, been following all the different races. The Directors Guild gave their award last night. So Shape of Things was the last song that we just heard, and Shape of Water won the Best Director Award for Guillermo del Toro, which is actually kind of interesting, because if Guillermo del Toro wins the Best Director Oscar, that'll be I think, four of the last 5 years, one of the three amigos, which are these three filmmakers from Mexico, which is Alfonso Cuarón, who won for Gravity, and then Alejandro Iñárritu, who won for Birdman, and then also for The Revenant. And now you'll have Guillermo del Toro winning for Shape of Water. So Mexican filmmakers winning the Oscars, interesting sort of thing right now.
Yeah, you think it should win?
Do I think Shape of Water should win? Well, this is interesting, Chris. Last night, I rewatched a movie that you and I saw together for the first time, and that was Dunkirk.
Mm.
And I think Chris Nolan did a pretty fantastic job with Dunkirk. I don't know that that's the... I think that movie came out too early and doesn't have the emotional impact. You're sort of at that part of the year where you realize you're comparing apples and oranges and kumquats and all these different things that are not really comparable, but and part of the reason is that I don't think that there are a lot of movies that are sort of that huge, like the movie that you see, you're like, oh my God, that's the one. You have a lot of stuff that's kind of on a similar level of very high quality, but nobody really agrees on how great it is. I like The Shape of Water very much. It's a real fable. It's an odd story. It's not the kind of movie that you think of winning Best Picture, but then again, neither was Birdman, so neither was Moonlight, for that matter. That felt like the kind of thing that would win the Spirit Awards. So I have a whole theory on that, too. But I don't know. What do you think should win?
Well, my two favorite films were not nominated for Best Picture.
Mudbound being one of them?
Mudbound was one of them, which is a movie that you can see on Netflix, if you've got Netflix out there, which is a beautiful story about two families in the South who are sort of tied in poverty, you might say, one white, one black. And it's this film about, I was writing about it a couple of weeks ago, it's this sort of film about how the Second World War really changed things in America, that even though it didn't immediately change things, it certainly set in motion the idea of change. Because one of the central characters in Mudbound, African American guy, goes off. He's a goes off to war, and when he gets back, although he's in sort of the Jim Crow South, he has a fellowship with a friendship with a white guy down the street, literally from him, who remembers that there were African-American fighter pilots who saved his life in the war. And therefore, you begin to see the thawing, you know, at least the beginnings of change. And I thought it was a very, very beautiful film. I think it's nominated for cinematography, right? Which is beautiful cinematography.
Yeah, and it's the first woman who's been nominated for cinematography ever, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah.
It's also up for best screenplay by Virgil Williams. It's adapted screenplay.
So that's number one. And then number two, you probably
and Mary J. Blige is up for supporting actress.
Right. Number two film that I think is the best, I think I would probably give it this film even over Mudbound, was also not nominated for Best Picture. And that, my dear friend, is The Florida Project.
Ah, see, there we watched that one together, too.
So that one, if you haven't seen that, folks.
I thought that would be nominated.
That one, if you haven't seen it, is about a, it's sort of, it's set on the edge of Disney World, in just outside Orlando, obviously. And it's set in a motel, and it's sort of about people in poverty who are trying to sort of get by, even though the most happiest place on earth is literally, I don't know, half a mile away from where they're living. And it's focused on a girl and one family, a single mother and her daughter, and this daughter and her daughter's best friend. And you just, for most of the movie, you watch these two kids play. And then you're like, oh, this is not much of a movie. There's not really much of a plot. It's just a kind of slice of life thing. And then it becomes a very, very, very intense narrative that really makes you understand how people in America get in trouble. And then they get in a hole and they fall farther and farther into this hole, this sort of cycle of poverty.
Right.
They can't get out, and it becomes impossible to get out. And if they have kids, those kids are right down there in the hole with them. And it's just this sort of, it's one of those films that makes you want to go out and change the structure that the film is writing about, or the film is about. And it made me cry toward the end. I've never seen a movie that takes children's play and makes such a sort of plot out of it. And why was that not nominated?
I would have nominated, absolutely. And in fact, I have a competition with this friend of mine, which we've been doing for years and years and years. And the reason I lost is because I had that getting nominated instead of Darkest Hour.
Yeah.
This is why I think that didn't get nominated, because I think that a lot of people are watching these movies on their DVDs and they're sitting there, and the first half of that movie is really, it's so episodic and kind of meandering, and you're just sort of following these characters who, I mean, Willem Dafoe is a real, you know, movie star in that, who's fantastic in the movie as the guy who owns this motel.
Yeah.
But for the most part, you're, as you said, you're watching these kids kind of run around and play and kind of being horrible sometimes and really sweet sometimes. And it has this, and I'm sure that there are people who are sitting there with their little Oscar friends in Los Angeles, and they're like, I don't want to watch this. I'm tired of it. And if you don't get, and you really have to get to the end of that movie, because it has such a cumulative impact where you're like, you get the, and it's not like there's a twist or anything. It's just that when that movie's over, you're like, oh, wow, that really added up to much more than while I was watching it, I thought it would. And if you don't stick with it all the way through, and if you lose your patience with it, which these Oscar voters probably did, that's probably why it didn't get nominated. Because I think if you get to the end of that movie, you're putting that movie up for best.
You know, it was interesting you were talking about Dunkirk. So I too saw Dunkirk twice, and I enjoyed it a lot. The first time, I missed a lot of stuff in that movie. It took me two viewings to understand Dunkirk, which I also think is an Oscar-worthy movie in many ways. I guess I privilege multiple plots. You know, I like films with a lot of plot. Like, if you look at, say, Lady Bird, which is a beautiful film, right? It's not got a lot of plots, if you know what I mean.
Right.
It's one story, and it's a lovely
little
story.
But it's really well done.
Of course, yes. I don't dispute that. I think it is beautifully done. But, well, you know, there's so much to talk about.
Well, you know, yeah, Three Billboards has a lot of stuff going on, but I don't feel like it quite adds up. Dunkirk is three different storylines that all intersect in three different timelines, and I don't know. I was rewatching Dunkirk. I just thought, if this had come out in December, you would still be like in that wow sort of mode. And now it's already kind of faded. And the problem with Dunkirk is that it doesn't have these individual characters who you latch onto in the way that you absolutely do in Lady Bird. You absolutely do in Florida Project.
Yeah, and Three Billboards too, even, right? You sort of latch on to on to those characters?
You're entertained by them. I mean, Frances McDormand is just kicking butt the whole time, and she's great, but she's not someone who you're warming up to. You're just sort of being entertained by her. And Sam Rockwell is this, you know, bad racist cop who, you know, I'm not going to say what happens, but it's one of the things that some people have the problem with. It doesn't really hold together is the problem. I think Get Out actually has sort of a sleeper shot of
I do too.
So you never know. But I think the Oscars they vote for, it's like a combination of things. One is, what was the greatest achievement? And that's where you get something like Birdman or, you know, Dunkirk.
You mean artistic?
Just achievement. You know, what that was like, wow, how did they do that? Like Lady Bird is really great, but it's a small movie and nobody's walking around going, how did they do that?
Right. You feel like you could have done it. You do sort of think, well, I could have written that story.
Shape of Water has such a sort of magical, strange quality to it that there is something about like, wow, that was really an achievement or something like that. So I think Shape of Water, and so Shape of Water just won Directors Guild, it won Producers Guild, Three Billboards won the SAG Award, which is the actors, and the actors are the biggest faction.
Right.
So there's been
a
sense that Three Billboards or Shape of Water is going to win, and maybe Three Billboards, but then Martin McDonagh was not nominated for director, and there aren't that many movies that win when your director isn't nominated.
So I don't know if we've got a break, but when we get back, I want to tell this, I want to just sort of talk this story about the you know, it's interesting how Dunkirk and The Darkest Hour tell this sort of parallel story. So
I saw Darkest Hour on Thursday night, and Mary hadn't seen, my wife hadn't seen Dunkirk, so we did that Saturday night, and it was fun to see this. They have the same ending of the movie. All right, we're going to be right back talking more about best films of the year and getting to some of your texts and calls. We'll be right back after this. Mark Caro and Chris Jones on After Hours. Welcome back, everybody. It's Mark Caro and Chris Jones.
Hey, everybody.
Filling in for Rick Hogan on After Hours. We are trying to make you have a... I had to just pause so you could hear Lady Bird in there. We're trying to make your Sunday super up to the very end. We're talking about movies, best movies of the year, the Oscar race, and all of this. And I'm very happy to be filling in for Rick Hogan right now, aren't you?
It's a very distinguished show, this.
He needs at least two people to fill in for
Loyal
Rick.
Listeners.
Rick is like, I've known Rick for so long. And
loyal
he's just,
listeners.
He's awesome. And we're like, you know, if you put us together,
we're about half of Rick. Half of
Rick. Yeah, up to half awesome. We're just like awe. We're just the awe part. Hey, so, we have a text from someone in Monroe, Wisconsin that says, best movie, The Post. We should be saying that, right? It's a newspaper movie.
Well, it's a good movie. I don't think it's a great movie. So when, you know, when I, the Boston movie, the Spotlight movie, I looked at that and I thought, this is my job. This is the newsroom. Just like the newsroom I work in, I recognize everything about that movie. When I watch The Post, I go, this is an aspirational movie of how journalism should be. When all the people with the money are making all the right moral decisions. And it is certainly a veneer of belief and romanticism. But you could argue that's why it's a movie and not a documentary, right? So I enjoyed The Post. I didn't think it was a great movie.
I really like The Post. I really like sitting through it with my family and seeing those values championed and seeing it now. And clearly that movie is trying to echo things that are happening in this country right now. I thought it was I felt like I'm just watching pros at work. They made this movie very quickly. I mean, Steven Spielberg has Ready Player One about to open in March, and he made this movie after he finished that one. They started on this movie in February, and they had it in theaters, and Meryl Streep is fantastic in it, and Tom Hanks is okay. I just thought I was really enjoying seeing pros at work doing that kind of job. That said, did it stick with me? No, it really didn't. And if that movie had come out in June, I bet it wouldn't have even been nominated for Best Picture. It doesn't have whatever those qualities are in a movie to sort of stick to your guts and make you think about it. The way when Florida Project ended, I said to you guys, this movie is going to stick with us. Because it just has that uneasy sort of like, I just lived through something that's going to stick with me. And I didn't feel that way about The Post, but I thoroughly enjoyed The Post. The Post, a mere two nominations, one for Best Actress, Meryl Streep, her 21st, but the other one, Best Picture. So he got that at least. Now, you saw two best... You wanted to talk about the parallels, the sort of bookends of two of the Best Picture nominees and how they're telling the same story from different points
of view. You know, so it's actually the difference in... So there's an incident. If you've seen The Darkest Hour, which I know you have, which is about Churchill, which has a very, very great central...
Gary Oldman, who will probably win for
as well
actor.
He should. And if you're a Churchillian, as some people are, a lot of people are not that happy with that portrayal of Churchill. It's sort of anti-heroic. He's sort of a drunk in the movie. He's a functional alcoholic. He drinks during the day, and they say, you know, how do you manage to drink during the day? And he says, practice. But it's a bit of an anti-heroic portrait of Churchill.
Except for him saving the country.
Well, there is that. But the actual image of him is very different from, trust me, from the what we're all spoon-fed in the UK, God knows, as kids. It's very, very different. It's quite a radical film, actually. And the other sort of scene in the film is he takes a trip on the subway train, which never happened.
I was wondering about that.
Never happened. And all these Brits go, stiff up a lip, Mr. Churchill, stiff up a lip.
Oh, when the girl comes in, and it was like, I thought, oh my God, this is just the British Lincoln. Yeah. It's like, it's a Spielberg movie,
yes,
but it's another guy.
Well, that scene, you know, the idea of the film is, again, it's a very 2018 idea that you can't be a leader unless you've consulted the people. Like, you know, Churchill, trust me, was not riding around on the subway train getting pointers from the regular folks before he gave his "We Will Fight Him on the Beaches" scene. But, you know, that's fine. What I wanted to talk about...
I'm really disappointed that didn't happen.
It didn't happen. I got into it with it. I wrote about this in the Tribune, and I got into it with people who knew a lot more about Churchill than I did, as there may well be people out there listening who do. But this is the point I wanted to make, and if there's somebody out there who knows more about this, it's sort of interesting to me. In The Darkest Hour, which is about the Dunkirk business, there is this garrison, this British garrison in Calais, where everybody gets killed, essentially.
Right.
So what he does is he says, Churchill makes this terrible decision, you have to stay there and essentially draw fire from the Nazis so we can rescue everybody from Dunkirk. And there's these horrible scenes that The Darkest Hour has a lot of shots from above all the time. There's an obsession with that. And there's all and you see everybody get killed in this garrison, and it's a huge, you begin to understand Dunkirk through what happened in Calais. Now, the movie Dunkirk barely mentions anybody in Calais.
There's one part where they say, why aren't we going to Calais?
Right.
Instead?
But there's no sense of these guns, because the point of Dunkirk is that all the guns are actually trained on Dunkirk, which they certainly were. But it's fascinating how you've essentially got two movies, both nominated for an Oscar, both talking about what happened in Dunkirk, with really very different takes on, you know, who was to blame, because really in Dunkirk, Churchill comes off badly. He comes off as not that caring, whereas, of course, in Darkest Hour, he comes off as brilliant tactician by drawing the guns away and saving the British Army.
Right.
So it's a fascinating, it's just a reminder of how movies about history, it all depends on the take of the director or the writers.
Well, Dunkirk has a huge omission in it that I didn't even notice when I saw it the first time, and my wife had read about it and pointed it out, and sure enough, when I watched it again, which is that they never mention once the word Nazi. Nazis are never
intentionally
mentioned.
Or not intentionally?
It's always the enemy. The enemy is coming. The enemy is coming. There's one line about, are you a Kraut or something? But other than that, there's no mention of, and I don't know what to make of it particularly, but they never say, oh, the Nazis are coming. That's Nazi fire, or any of that. Like it's almost like, well, back then they would never have referred to the Nazis. Like, I don't know why. I don't know what to make of it, but it's sort of an odd.
But they would have said the Germans, surely, wouldn't they? They wouldn't have just said the enemy.
They keep saying the enemy.
Well, if someone is out there who knows. You could give us a call.
It's always the enemy.
312-981-7200. Tell us if we know what we're talking about, because we're delving into World War II history that we're not experts on. So
please do. And, you know, all right. And I want to go back to Lady Bird for a second, because, and we've talked about this movie before, but Best Supporting Actress is going to be Laurie Metcalf or Lady Bird or Allison Janney for I, Tanya. Mm. And I, Tanya, I think you should watch I, Tanya and Florida Project back to back, because I was in the minority on I, Tanya. I did not love I, Tanya. I just feel like it has this weird kind of satirical note to it, but I don't know what it's satirizing particularly. Mm. But Allison Janney actually won the SAG Award. She won the Golden Globe, and everyone thinks she's going to win. And both of them, Allison Janney and Steppenwolf's Laurie Metcalf, are both playing these problematic mothers. Laurie Metcalf playing a problematic mother who deep down loves her daughter, and Allison Janney playing a problematic mother who deep down is horrible. And she's horrible throughout. And she's just a horrible person. And the filmmaker, in case you don't get it, when she comes on screen, plays Devil Woman by Cliff Richard. So they are pounding this thing into you. She is bad. But everyone enjoys it because it's Allison Janney, and she's a respected actress. And so Allison Janney's probably going to win for Best Supporting Actress. But if any Academy voters are listening right now, come on, Laurie Metcalf. There is so much more nuance to that performance.
It's got to be Laurie Metcalf. It has to be.
It has to be. Won't be, though.
First, I mean,
Laurie Metcalf makes, I heard one theory that says, well, Laurie Metcalf makes a lot of women feel guilty and bad because they relate to her, whereas Allison Janney, there's enough of a distance they could just enjoy how horrible she is, like slapping around Tonya Harding. It's like, okay, I guess so.
Well, let's just pause to point out the number of Chicago theater actors in these movies. So you've got Laurie Metcalf, right? And then you've got The Post, very big role,
right,
for Carrie Tracy
Coon.
Letts, for Tracy Letts, and Carrie Coon.
Right. And Tracy then, Letts also in playing the dad in Lady Bird.
That's right, too. Tracy
married to
Letts
Laurie
in
Metcalf.
Lady Bird. And then you've
all... I have a good one from Lady Bird, too.
What?
Chris Witowski played the business jock, and he was the guy that was interviewing the dad.
I interviewed him on my podcast.
Back in the summer, Chris, he's a really great guy, and it was like so fun to see him on a big screen. He's in Love on Netflix. Judd Apatow's.
And then, you know, if you look really closely at The Post, you can find Jesse Mueller, the star of Chicago musicals,
yeah,
playing Judith Martin.
I was gonna say she's the society cop.
She's
Judith
from Evanston, and I used to have her as a student.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
Along with her sister and her brother.
The lovely Abby. The Mueller's. There's so many Mueller's. You never know. I can never keep up with all the Mueller's.
Right. Yeah. And Lois Smith also in Lady Bird.
Yes,
so
Lois Smith.
Those two movies.
I would argue more than ever in those Oscar movies. More Chicago than ever.
I think, well, Roger, since you're there, we probably should throw it to you.
You can toss it. You don't have to throw it.
We're gonna lob it gently.
Thank you.
Welcome back to WGN After Hours. This is Mark Caro with Chris Jones. We are filling in for Rick Kogan, and we are thinking about tweet, 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 because Twitter's been in the news a little bit, and we're going to talk about this whole notion of Twitter and followers and buying them and all of that. And, you know, our colleague over at the Sun-Times, Richard Roper, mentioned in this New York Times story that came out a week ago. And it mentioned that he was one of many media figures and public figures who had purchased Twitter followers. And the Sun-Times suspended him for a few days. They suspended him. He was not in print.
They made this distinction. Truly, they made this distinction between suspending his column, but not him. But anyway.
Well, they didn't, but they suspended his work from appearing in the
paper. Correct. That part's
correct. So they didn't suspend him I take it back. I did not mean that they suspended him without pay or something like that, but he was barred from having his work appear in the paper. If you're a film critic, your stuff shows up on Fridays. There was not actually a Friday during which this took place, I don't think. So maybe it didn't. Anyway, while they were investigating it, and they'd found that he had purchased, I think, something like 50,000 at least on six different occasions. And their conclusion was that they'd announced that he was going to be a columnist as well as being the film critic, he originally was a columnist at the Sun-Times. He's been film critic since Roger Ebert passed away. And I think he was going to be wearing both hats again. And now he's going to continue being a film critic, but not be doing a general news column. So, Chris Jones.
All right, my view is nothing wrong with it. Nothing wrong with it. Nothing wrong with it. My view of that is that, you know, this was something that he did to burnish his brand, so to speak.
Right, that's what he said.
I think that's fair enough. I don't think necessarily that because Twitter has a number of followers next to it, that it is an inherent guarantee of anything. I think all kinds of people present company accepted, have been known to purchase Twitter followers, including...
What does that mean?
Well, I think institutions have purchased Twitter followers. Like, I think, I don't think it's on, it's been uncommon. Indeed, the New York Times story said it was not. I don't see it. I see the argument against it, that it's, you know, that I think the theory being that if you're a journalist, you shouldn't inflate your Twitter followers. And it's true in show business, especially, that if you're up for a role and I'm up for a role and we're equally good, imagine that, we're equally good, they're going to go away. They're going, if you have a million followers, I have 10,000, whatever it is, right, is going to go to you. And that might apply to contracts and all that. But I don't think, I just think that's what you do. He's just trying to get an audience. I haven't purchased Twitter followers, but I'm not morally opposed to it.
You and I have had similar, same bosses at times.
Yes.
And there's definitely a, you know, a value put on having a large following online, right?
Yes.
So
a monetary value, right?
Right. So, yes. Like, you as someone who has a job and wants your job, thank you. You want to be able to, you know, say, yeah, I have this many followers,
yes,
and that means I have this much reach, and you're representing that this is what your reach is. Now, 50,000 member people of that reach of like a couple hundred thousand are not true, or, you know, 60% are not real, you're misrepresenting what your reach is, correct?
No, I don't think so, because I think you're attempting to buy reach. So now,
but if these are all bots, if these are like not real people, these are like counterfeit identities, these are not actual eyeballs on your column, these are just numbers that are showing up on your feed, but you're not actually being read by any more people.
Well, I think you're getting there at a sort of a complexity of this, which is the idea that if you're buying Twitter, if you purchase Twitter followers, I think the companies that have historically sold Twitter followers have represented that those are real people. In other words, you would like, you know, as a, you would like to reach more people. And here I've got for $500, I can put your work in front of another 10,000 people. I don't see anything wrong with that, because I think it's not that different from, you know, all kinds of people juice social media all the time. All the outrage that you read in your Facebook feed is not all real. A lot of it is paid for in service of some cause or some product or another. So I hear that point. I do. I hear that point that there's something duplicitous about it. But I suppose the question is, and I think in this case, they were not real. And in fact, you know, there's a thing out there now, Con, if you've seen this, it's called TwitterAudit.com.
Right.
So you can actually, yeah, you can take anybody and you can look at their followers. You might want to try this right now. You can go to TwitterAudit.com. You can look at somebody and you can see how many of their followers are real.
My wife does radio on another, yeah, station, and she goes through all of her followers, and the ones that are bots or they look like they're not real people, she just blocks.
Wow, that's
she
right.
gets rid
wow.
of them. So she wow. is like actually, and the reason she does this is that she doesn't like her stuff going out to the bots, and sometimes because she's giving the news on WXRT, she will be talking about, she'll give a very straightforward newscast, and they will post the newscast on Facebook or they will post it on online, and if there's something in there that some people don't like, all of a sudden she'll get like attacked by all these bots. And it's almost like there's like, if you have like words in there or something, and I think that her feeling is, I don't want to be part of sort of the bot thing where maybe it's not even humans responding to it. And there's something, there's this weird sort of creepy area that gets into, that we're maybe moving toward, where you can drum up a lot of outrage on Twitter and social media from these, you know, your digital people who are also, yes, going to be playing,
yeah,
football,
yeah,
as you discussed earlier. So it's an interesting thing. I have not been as diligent to go through and see, well, who's following me. I mean, I have like 4,500 followers, which is okay, but it's not that many more than I had, you know, before I left the Tribune. I think you probably have a little more.
7,500.
Yeah. So you know, it's funny. I was once with a celebrity we were in a car going to a place where we were going to be having a talk, and he said, you know, if you want to get more Twitter followers, post something about My Little Pony. If you say something about bronies or something, you will get all these My Little Pony followers. And we might have just done it in the car, even just to sort of for laughs. But in a sense, you know, you're sort of getting fake followers then too. But I assume those are real people. And I guess part of the question on this whole buy and followers thing is if you think that you're actually buying real people who will look at your work, that's different from
that is, I think, what was represented by these companies.
Yeah.
Initially.
So that's part of what the gray area is. And obviously the Sun-Times, you know, the newspaper did not have a policy against that. So I'm not advocating that he should have been punished more harshly. I actually find it interesting, this notion that he can write movie reviews but not write news columns now. What do you think of that distinction?
I think that's nonsense. I think, you know, the arts are to, there shouldn't be any distinction. Do you have fake followers there?
Oh, so no, actually, I don't. Thanks for asking. Yeah.
We thought you were going to fess
like a
up.
Good idea, though.
We thought you were just going to fess up
no,
on the
come on. I just wanted to throw this in there. Another job of mine, I have so many. But I'm the marketing director for a startup kind of thing, an organic deodorant company in Hinsdale. And I'm growing their social media, and that is so hard. It's like a really hard thing to do.
How do you grow social media?
Exactly. Without buying followers. So that's the it's a slippery slope because you don't want to be desperate.
Yeah.
Like, because for a while it was like whoever was managing the account before me would just follow everybody that they possibly could.
Right.
So we were following like 3,000 people and we only followed by 200. I was like,
And so then your ratio is bad and that gets judged
too. It was dumb.
Too.
I was like, I would never trust a business that had a ratio like that. The only people we should follow is people that work here.
Well, there is the issue of it's not really about how many you have. It's about who they are, right? Like, if there are people with small Twitter followers who have highly influential people who, you know, follow
exactly.
them.
Yeah.
I mean, do you ever watch the show Silicon Valley?
Yes.
I mean, there was a whole plot in there where they were purchasing users for this
Pied Piper
their product and when it was discovered that they were doing this, it was a huge scandal that they were misrepresenting and all their investors were going to go crazy, and it killed their whole deal because they were purchasing users and misrepresenting the numbers. So there is a value to actually being able to trust numbers, and when you're in the journalism business, you are in the trust business, and so that's where you get the kind of gray area on the other side of like, yeah, if what you're representing isn't really what you've actually reached, it does feel a little bit iffy. I think ultimately it comes down to, I mean, yeah, this is a misdemeanor more than a felony, and it's really just all about the writer. You know, in this case, Richard Roper, who's someone who's been in town for a long time. People know his work. If you trust his work, you like him, you like where he's coming from, I don't think you're going to like all that stuff less because of this. If you have a problem with his work or you don't trust him, then you might, you know, confirm for you to some extent, you know, there's just something off there.
I say nothing wrong with it. I still say it. I'm like, I got it. I understand why he did it. I don't think it's...
And you think he should be writing news columns, too?
Yes, I do. I don't see that. I don't think there's any reason to, you know, that's just my view on it. That's what I think.
Yeah, I think part of that statement they had said, you know, we will not be discussing this further. But I'd actually like to see him discuss it further. I'd like to see him write a news column about this and kind of get into it and apply that intelligence of his to this topic. And then I would not... you know, I would not have a problem reading columns by him otherwise. So, anyway.
We have a caller.
Oh, we have a caller. Okay.
On this topic, I think.
Let's talk to Ray.
Chris and Mark, I'm thoroughly enjoying your show.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Mark, I've always respected your work.
Wow.
Thank you.
Chris, I think you're transcendent, and I'm not saying that to be patronizing.
Oh, stop.
No.
I love this caller.
Chris, I went to the extent of reading your background only because of the implicit empathy in shows you clearly don't like.
Thank you.
No, I'm serious.
It's very kind of you. Thank you.
No, for a theater critic, and even for a rock critic, it's when you don't like things, but you're at least giving it a chance. You're going to the show. You're going to review it. Mark, you're listening to a record you know you're not going to like. Anyway, I didn't mean to get off topic. You fellas are talking about Rich Roper and the whole Twitter thing.
Yes.
Number one, I definitely think for as hypocritical and gratuitous an operation as the Chicago Sun-Times to call a Rich Roper on the carpet over something like this, he should have resigned of his own will and volition. He should have said, hey, fellas, thanks for the ascent. I'm more than set forever. I can go on doing books and movie reviews. I don't need you. You need me more than I need you. He had too much class and dignity to do that.
So you think he should have quit the Sun-Times over them even putting his stuff on hold?
I think he and Chris Fusco and Ed Eisendrath should have had a brief conversation, and I'm sure his agent would have been involved. I don't know if it's still Todd Musburger or not. And Rich just should have said, are you people serious? Because one of you just
I don't disagree with you.
One of you just said something to the effect it's a misdemeanor at worst. I think I'd even lower it.
Well, that's what Chris says. Yeah, Chris thinks there's nothing.
Nothing wrong.
I think it's all murky, and I think it's all part of this new media digital world that we're living in. And I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with I put it this way. I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with looking into this, and I don't want to dispute the motives of, you know, Chris Fusco over there at the Sun-Times, or, you know, I don't know if Eisendrath was involved or any of those people, or Roper for that matter. It was in the New York Times. Do you need to announce that you're doing this quote unquote investigation as opposed to just like calling them up and just figuring it out over a few days and then just sort of dealing with it? I don't know. I mean, that said, newspaper careers are long and we all have our ups and downs.
Yeah, we feel
all of us have felt very slighted by our employers at some points and appreciated other points. And, you know, I would say in the long run, if everyone is behaving well, life should go on as it was.
Mark, I think what you just said is absolutely true. If they were going to do an investigation, keep it in-house and then come to your conclusion.
Yeah.
And if you were to go back to classic newspaper ethicality, and we're talking about an era of like 40 years ago, like when you two were chatting about the Post and to me the grossly over-aggrandized Ben Bradley, who I think is one of the all-time frauds. Just track with me for a second.
Yes.
Ben Bradley.
But Jason Robards was great as
him. Yeah, but no. In 1973, Ben Bradley came out with a book near the 10th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination. It wasn't called With Kennedy, but I'm close on the title. It was something Kennedy and about his great friendship with Kennedy. What did the Washington Post do in the wake of the assassination to pursue truth to the extent that a Dorothy Kilgallen did? The Washington Post did nothing. Now, granted, Bradley was not in a position of authority till 1965, but nonetheless, when you talk about hypocrisy, to me, there it is inherent. Again, I digress. Mark, back to the point you were making, and Chris, thank you too for indulging me. Newspapers, why couldn't you tell your writers, your columnists, your critics, stay on Twitter? We're just going to delete your number of followers.
Yeah.
Above and beyond that, stay in bounds. Promote our product. Promote your brand.
Yeah.
Well, and editors, again, and thank you so much for
our call, Ray. Thank
you for
calling,
Ray. We really appreciate it. Editors want you to have big followings so that, you know, your digital people at newspapers are encouraging you to have more followers and will give you tips on how to have more followers too. So, I have no idea what those, conversations would have been, but certainly newspapers want those followers. So these are part of the values.
And we got some more journalism to talk, right?
Yeah, I was going
to
say, speaking of the Sun-Times, there's a theater critic who, oh, wait, I'm sorry. Are we going to break now? Okay, I'm going to keep going then. I'm going to cue up Chris Jones right here. Chris Jones, you've had a competitor across the street or across town now as a theater critic.
Hedy Weiss.
And she's been a formidable, force in Chicago journalism for, I think, 33 years she's been at the Sun-Times.
13,000 reviews, Mark Carroll.
13,000.
Now, you've written a lot of reviews yourself on many topics, but I don't know that you've done 13,000.
No, not that many.
I've written the odd one myself. I don't think I'm 13,000. I'm not far off, frankly, but I'm not quite that level.
So we don't know what they're going to be doing over there. They've said something about future, something or other, but as of what we know now, as of the end of last week, Hedy Weiss is no longer the
She's had her she's her last day. Her last review was of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra on Thursday. Friday was her last day at the paper. I am going to miss her terribly. I consider her a class act in every way. I think she is one of the many formidable women journalists in this city who have written about the arts. I'm talking here about people like great Claudia Cassidy. She is every bit their equal. She is unbound. proud. She has never compromised. She has never apologized. She has, to perhaps to a fault, but
she's been asked to apologize sometimes.
She has not done so because she believes very strongly that in the right to freedom of expression and into having her opinion, and that's how she's gone out. And she has gone out on on those terms. Now, I think probably some of us would say, you know, the business has changed. People want conversations more than they previously did. But I think, you know, I have nothing but respect for really a truly great Chicago journalist who I am going to miss personally and professionally more than I can say.
It's going to change the landscape. We do have to take a break right now, but let's get back to it. We're going to talk a little more about Hedy Weiss, and maybe we'll talk about Uma Thurman or something as we wrap up the show. But we're coming right back after hours, Mark Caro and Chris Jones on WGN Radio. Welcome back to WGN After Hours with Rick Kogan, filling in for Rick Kogan. It's Mark Caro and Chris Jones. Say hello, Chris.
Hey there, everybody.
Hello, Chris. We were just discussing Hedy Weiss finishing up her illustrious career at the Chicago Sun-Times. Yeah, I just saw her at The Humans, the opening for that last week.
Show? Did you like that show? That's a great play.
I did like that show, but I didn't like it as much as you did, because you think it's like one of the great transcendent things.
Baby.
And really, what my reaction to...
Tony Award.
I know, and Pulitzer too, right?
No, Hamilton, because it was the year. Had it not been for Hamilton, it would have won
Tony,
the
Pulitzer.
Tony.
Well, no, and it came out, and it started out at the ATC.
Yes.
On, you know, Lincoln Avenue, right? And I wish I'd seen it there, because I just feel like that intimate experience I would have had there, as opposed to seeing it at the Congress where...
Cadillac Palace. Yeah.
Cadillac Palace, I mean, yeah, Congress is it. Yeah, the Cadillac Palace where... It's this intimate story, and we had, you know, wonderful seats and everything, but everyone's like, we're all kind of leaning forward, just trying to make sure we were hearing everything. And it just was a little bit, it's sort of a small play in a big space now. And I don't know whether that affected my viewing of it in a way that it didn't affect you, because you'd seen it before.
Yeah.
Or whether I just reacted to the play differently, which is, I thought it was very nice, but kind of low stakes.
This is a play, if you don't know what we're talking about, it's a play by Stephen Karam. It's a play really about, it's just about a family having Thanksgiving together in New York. They're grown-up kids, and a lot of it's about centered on the father of this family, who's a sort of 55-ish, 60-ish guy who's made mistakes in his life. And he suffered through 9/11. He was in New York. He was literally waiting to go to the World Trade Center, which luckily didn't open until 9:30. And it's just about the pain of life. And there's also his mother has Alzheimer's. And so if anyone out there has been through Alzheimer's, you'll recognize, as I have with my dad, you recognize this as really true, I think.
I believed it was all true.
Yeah, it's a very honest play. It's a beautiful play. It's only here for a week. I like it a tremendous amount. But Mark is right.
Sit
it
close.
Is big theater.
Go
down front.
If you're in the balcony for that thing, I just don't know how it would do, because I was like on the floor. And again, it was good, but I just...
Even if you're on the side, you're fine on the side if you get down front.
Yeah. It just felt a little low stakes to me. Like I was relating to it, but the revelations weren't... But I feel bad because even complaining about it. It was very nice, well done play. And it was nice seeing Hedy there.
Yeah.
She did not let on at all that like the next day or the day after it was going to be revealed that her career at the Sun-Times was over. And, you know, I just wish her the best. And I also wish Chicago theater arts coverage the best, because you need all these voices out there. And, you know, there are people who say, well, we need these other voices to be heard. Yes, we need the Hedys. We need the Chrises, and we need all those other voices, because it's, this town is big enough and deserves it all. And that's what I have to say. And
what a lovely note to end our show on, Mark.
Absolutely. And so we're going to end our show on this right now. Do we have another 2 hours?
We don't. People are wishing out there. They're like, oh, these guys leaving.
We could keep talking. We could go right back to Justin Timberlake. Okay, thank you so much for Chris Jones, Mark Caro, filling in. Rick Hogan will be back.
And our fabulous producer.
Our fabulous producer, Lise. You were awesome. You did so great. If I had time, I would like have you give a full review of the Justin Timberlake album right now.
Okay. Well,
we got to throw it to Noah.
I'll do it. I'll just post it separately.
We'll talk during the news. I would never talk over Roger, though.
Oh,
this is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com.